Hello, it's Wednesday 13th of May. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
On today's show, we're addressing the hottest topic in travel, Chinese tourism, and when will it return?
Yeah, there's a growing feeling that Southeast Asia could become a benchmark for the recovery or otherwise of Chinese travel globally. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. As we near the halfway point of 2020, can you believe it? Which has been truly dire so far for the travel industry. The focus is on trying to turn around the situation in the second half of the year. With that in mind, every country in our region is desperate to welcome back Chinese travellers.
Absolutely, Hannah. The influence of Chinese travellers and of the Chinese travel industry as a whole skyrocketed through the 2010s. And by the end of 2019, China was the largest inbound market for most countries in our region. In some cases, by a considerable margin. But the context has changed since January, not just because the coronavirus emanated in China. So there are now a lot of overlapping factors to consider when looking at the potential rebound of Chinese outbound tourism. But as you said there, Hannah, there is a sense emerging across the region that some form of post-COVID-19 travel recovery, albeit on a probably a limited scale, may be within grasp. We're seeing a few movements, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
But domestic and intra-regional travel are going to be the initial priorities in our region. We know that. And that will probably endure through to the end of this year at least. But all destinations are desperate for the return of Chinese spending power. So we're going to break down the question of will Chinese travelers return anytime soon by looking at the opportunities and challenges here in Southeast Asia in the different markets. And also, most importantly, by looking at the supply side factors in China.
As we know, China is a continental sized country, and it's such a huge topic to address because the Chinese outbound market has so many sub-regional drivers and demographic factors. So let's start by going back in time. Gary, you've been working in and around the Chinese travel sector since the early 2000s. You're an expert, really, aren't you? And you even wrote a book, The New Chinese Traveler, back in 2014. So you start. Where do we start?
Well, that's a good point. Often on this show, we actually like to go back to try and tell the current story and look ahead. But I think it's important to go back. So I moved to Shanghai in early 2004. And that was when the impact of SARS was still evident in China's domestic travel sector, which was still in its early stages. It was nowhere near like it is today, and nor was the outbound market. The outbound market was growing, but it was still relatively nascent at that time. But there was a big development that happened in the outbound travel sector, and that was ADS.
What's ADS?
Now, throughout the 1990s, yeah, that's a good question. What is ADS? So throughout the 1990s and the first decade of the 2000s, the Chinese government negotiated and awarded approved destination status, ADS, on a bilateral basis with over 150 countries worldwide. Now, this was a phased rollout. Now, this enabled each of those approved countries to market their destinations to Chinese travelers. Initially, this was via approved tour group operators, so it was essentially group travel. Later on, obviously towards the end of the 2000s, we saw the growth of internet-driven independent travel booking. But initially, during the 2000s itself, ADS was a highly prized step for governments, and it was all over the travel media during that time. So also, it was important for NTOs, destination marketers, and airlines, as it offered for the first time access to China's emerging and mostly untapped outbound market. So why are we talking about this? Well, one of the most important things I think for our region is that Thailand was the first country to be awarded approved destination status. And Malaysia, Singapore and Philippines followed very, very quickly. Indeed, by 2000, when the global rollout of the ADS program began, Brunei, Cambodia, Myanmar and Vietnam had also secured ADS status, giving all of those countries a head start in marketing and operating Chinese tours. And remember, we're going back quite a way in time here. So Southeast Asia, for a number of factors, obviously including geographical proximity and airline access, emerged as a trusted testing ground to the Chinese government for its outbound tourism market, along with markets such as Hong Kong, Macau, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. Now, I think this element of trust is very important, and it's worth bearing in mind as we look ahead to what might transpire in the post-COVID-19 landscape.
Yeah, you're right. So let's fast forward to another milestone in the Chinese outbound story, and that's 2010. So 2010 was when Shanghai hosted the most visited World Expo in history. Historically, World Expos were viewed as global trade shows, really, for manufactured products and technical innovations. But 2010 was different, wasn't it, Gary?
Yeah, it was different. It was, because from the outset, the goal of the Chinese government was to host the largest travel trade show in history. And that's, I think it was awarded the rights to host the event back in about 2004, something like that. So for 6 years, there were huge preparations for this event. And once it actually happened, it was a six-month event. Governments and tourism boards from around the world hired big-name architects to design, you know, very special and very locally focused national pavilions. And over the 6 months of the show, which ran from May to October 2010, they promoted their destinations relentlessly, often flying in rare cultural treasures and artworks, sports and movie stars, pop stars and celebrity chefs. And the singular goal throughout those months was to entice Chinese new generation of travel curious consumers. And it worked. More than 70 million people attended the World Expo show over the 6 months. And since then, over the last decade, since 2010, we've witnessed a spectacular rise in Chinese outbound tourism worldwide, but especially here in Southeast Asia. And that really is no coincidence. The World Expo played a huge role in showcasing the world to Chinese travellers.
Ah, I didn't realise that that was such a pivotal moment, actually, in Chinese outbound tourism.
Yeah, it really was.
So let's then use 2010 as our base year for looking at arrivals into Southeast Asia. If we take 2011, which is the first full year after the 2010 World Expo, ASEAN welcomed a total of 81.2 million visitor arrivals. By 2018, 81.2 became 135.3 million. And much of that growth is, you know, really down to Chinese arrivals. But how much? So in 2013, and there's going to be a lot of stats here, but try and keep up. 2013, 12.6 million arrivals into the 10 ASEAN countries were from China, or about 12.4% of the total. By 2018, that figure had reached 29.1 million visitors, which is 21.5% of the total. So if you put that in a bit of context, the 10 ASEAN nations contributed, you know, intra-ASEAN travel about 49.72 million visitors across the region, while just China contributed 29.1 million, which is kind of amazing. So according to some pre-COVID-19 forecasts, annual arrivals into ASEAN by 2022 could have reached 155 million, with China likely to have contributed over 40 million arrivals by then. So again, China is really a huge driver behind international arrivals into ASEAN.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we said earlier, you know, that really is the sort of outflow from 2010. This has really generated a lot of interest and visitor arrivals from China throughout the last decade. So that brings us up to date in regional terms. But we did some research, didn't we, Hannah, to assess how important Chinese travelers actually are to some actual individual national markets. So firstly, I'm going to pick Thailand, which I think is one of the most interesting case studies. If you go back to 2010, China was the second largest market for Thailand in terms of tourists. But over the last decade, between 2010 and 2019, the number of arrivals to Thailand have increased by tenfold. So last year, in 2019, 28% of total arrivals to Thailand were from China. That was 10.99 million people. So how did this happen? Well, there's actually a very, very interesting story about how this happened. There's been a growth of arrivals throughout the decade. But actually, if you go back to 2012, this is when it really, really happened. So this was after the World Expo. There was interest in traveling to Thailand. But what actually kick-started this was a low-budget comedy movie called Lost in Thailand. Now, this movie was about two Chinese businessmen and a woman tourist in the city of Chiang Mai, and it got no pre-coverage at all. It was released just before Christmas, I think, late in the year. And all of a sudden, by the end of the year, something like 40 million people had watched this movie. It had generated a huge amount of interest in tourism into Thailand. But the fortuitous part of this happened at the end of the year, is that Chinese tour operators saw a chance to promote Chiang Mai and the movie for Chinese New Year, which followed the following February. So there was just this huge surge the following February of Chinese interest and travel to Thailand. And I think there was something like 4.7 million visitors in 2013, the year after the movie came out. And this happened at such a fast pace that even the Thai Prime Minister invited the director of the movie to a private audience to thank him for promoting Thai tourism.
That's really something. I mean, and actually, it's kind of incredible the impact that film locations does have, especially on tourism around Southeast Asia. I mean, even if I look at Europe, just to digress from China a little bit, for Switzerland at the moment, so many Southeast Asian travel agencies are promoting Switzerland because of crash landing on you. And now everyone wants to go to all the scenes where all these lovers were in Switzerland. It's really, again, another one of those kind of forces of nature. When you've just got the right movie in the right place, suddenly everyone wants to go.
It's really, really true. And what we've seen since then is, you know, a lot of actual national tourism authorities have actually commissioned to be part of movies that are being filmed, particularly from China, also from India as well. But, you know, this one is quite interesting because it was quite fortuitous. It didn't really have any pre-selling. There was no idea that this was actually going to actually have an impact on tourism, but it just actually did. It was just the right movie at the right time.
Nice. I didn't realize that that's why. That kind of kick-started the Chinese outbound market to Thailand. Interesting.
So your turn to choose a couple of markets, Anna.
So another market within Southeast Asia, Vietnam. Now, Chinese arrivals actually were up 16.9% year on year in 2019. And last year, Chinese visitors accounted for about 32% of total visitors. And if you look at the 2019 Chinese arrivals, they're more than four times greater than 2011's 1.4 million. Even if you're looking at the beginning of this year, and actually Vietnam had a really stunning January performance. They were really much further ahead year on year. But even in January, Chinese arrivals were up 72.6% year on year. So there's just a huge increase of Chinese visitors to Vietnam. If we turn to Philippines, again, Chinese outbound market has kind of exploded there. It's quadrupled. So in 2010, it had a 5% share. By 2019, it's got a 21% share. And it's gone from fourth place in terms of arrivals in 2010 to joint third in 2015 to the second biggest market in 2019, actually overtaking USA arrivals. I mean, and USA arrivals has always been a really key market for the Philippines, but China's beating that now. And now, actually, there is a very, very small difference between Korea and China last year. So it's just 3% difference, about 150,000 packs. And one of the nice, well, one of their little tricks, I guess, to get more Chinese to visit is actually visa-free for Chinese travellers, so long as they have a visa from other countries like USA, or they have a Schengen visa, something like that. Gary, what other countries have you got for us?
Okay, I'm going to pick up a couple of markets that are coming off a lower base. I'm going to look at Myanmar and Laos. So if you look at Laos, for example, it's one of the least visited countries in the region. It hasn't really developed its tourism promotion much over the past decade, but it has started to take steps. And last year was designated as China-Laos Tourism Year. So the aim was to increase the number of Chinese tourists. Remember that Laos has a border with China, so people can drive across the border to actually visit it. They wanted to achieve more than 1 million Chinese arrivals in a single year for the first time. And they achieved that. I think it was something like 1.02 million arrivals. And that accounted, so that was up 27% on the year before. And Laos only received 4.58 million visitors in total last year. The number one market is still Thailand, but China is catching up very, very fast. Another market coming off a relatively low base is Myanmar. Now, last year, China accounted for about 10% of visitors. Myanmar's had a lot of difficulties with the tourism industry, as we know, political difficulties, conflicts, and those kinds of things. But last year, Chinese arrivals increased, particularly towards the back end of the year. I think in December last year, the year-on-year arrivals figures for Chinese arrivals to Myanmar was up 117% on the previous December.
Okay, so my next pick, Indonesia. And that's an interesting one. Chinese are not really such a dominant tourism arrivals market as some of the other markets, you know, like Myanmar or like Vietnam. But they did almost double their share. So they went from 7% up to 13% last year, and their total arrivals have quadrupled. So now they're in second place in terms of nationalities. So first is Malaysia. And I mean, Malaysia had a 19% share. So China, with its 13% share, is still lagging some way behind. It's also got visa-free access for Chinese travellers as well, which they implemented in 2015. So that is going to have gone quite some way to boost those arrival numbers over recent years. Singapore, well, they are now the first place in terms of arrivals. Last year, they accounted, Chinese travellers accounted for 19%. Of Singapore's arrival market. So they're beating out Indonesia, which is their second top source market. And you can really see the impact actually of China being that top source market for Singapore. If you're looking at Singapore's arrival numbers, and already in January and February this year, you could see the impact of Chinese travelers not traveling to Singapore. And out of all of the regions and countries in ASEAN, Singapore was one of the earliest to be affected, I think, like I said in the last episode 17, wasn't it, when we were looking at 4 months of COVID. And my last pick for countries is Malaysia, our home. And here they have almost doubled the numbers of Chinese travellers. So they've gone from 7% in 2010 to 12% share last year. But they're still a long, long way from being number one, because Singapore has a 39% market share, which is just insane. But you can assume that many of those are just kind of they're just short trips. They're just border, across the border, potentially day trips. And Singaporean travellers are really not as valuable as Chinese travellers in terms of they just don't have as many overnights, so they don't do as much spend. But the really interesting thing about Malaysia was this year, obviously it's going to be Visit Malaysia 2020, and they had actually planned to waive visas for Chinese and Indian tourists. So that could have potentially been a real game changer in terms of arrival numbers for 2020. But we won't know, will we?
We won't know. So let's finish up with Cambodia, which the figures are pretty astonishing, like they are across the region. So in 2010, there were 177,636 Chinese arrivals to Cambodia. Fast forward to 2019, 2.36 million. Says it all. You don't really have to say any more about that. That's just that's astonishing growth. So here we are in May 2020, Hannah. COVID-19 has brought travel to a standstill, particularly in the last 2 months. And while some forecasters are busy crunching numbers, they are at this point still just using guesswork mostly. The trajectory of this virus is still unknown. You know, there have been concerns this week in the past few days in countries that we thought had sort of suppressed this virus particularly well. So China, South Korea, Germany are three cases. You know, where cases were starting to rise again, or you were seeing these little pockets, these little hotspots, once the lockdown restrictions have been eased. If you look into China, for example, they're now saying that they're going to have to test all 11 million people in the city of Wuhan, or even retest, because I imagine a lot of them already had tests anyway. So, you know, this fear and this idea that we are living with this virus, you know, and getting case numbers down to zero and keeping them at zero is going to be extremely different, for whether you have tourism or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that, you know, that recurrent uncertainty, yes, maybe we've flattened it now, is it going to come back again in winter? I mean, that's not going to help travel recovery. But in this region in Southeast Asia, we are starting to see some domestic flight restrictions eased, especially in places like Vietnam, where airlines have been told they're allowed to operate however many flights they want nowadays. They don't even have to keep the middle seat empty. We've seen things like AirAsia starting back up in Malaysia, flights in Thailand, and even Vietnam has started to talk about about opening up some international routes from the 1st of June, as are other players like AirAsia, Korean Air, Qatar Airways. But, you know, there's still that fear. Is there going to be a second wave? Is there going to be a third wave? It's quite hard for airlines and governments to plan ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said there, you know, there's this sort of feeling in the travel industry in this region that we're sort of in an in-between period. Perhaps we're over the worst of it for now from the first wave. We don't know when the second or third waves will or if they will hit. But obviously planning ahead is critical given the current financial problems and the liquidity situation across the travel ecosystem, you know, from airlines to hotels to travel agents, tour operators, small tourism businesses and tour guides. You know, everybody is suffering, that the entire ecosystem. Lockdowns are slowly being eased, as we said, in some parts of Southeast Asia, but international travel at the moment is still prohibited in the most part. As you said there, Hannah, there are some sort of pockets opening up, and we hope that that is able to happen in a greater volume in the coming months. But as you look at domestic travel, for example, here in Malaysia, that is definitely a focus. Thailand and Vietnam are both rolled out or about to roll out tourism campaigns for domestic tourism. You know, Singapore there is in a bit of a situation because it doesn't have any domestic tourism sector, and it relies heavily on connective air travel between the continents. And as we saw yesterday, Changi Airport has announced that it will actually operate from only two of its four terminals from this Saturday for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, that's crazy. And, you know, while most tourism boards in the region are launching domestic travel promotions and campaigns to generate tourism revenue through the end of 2020, there is this feeling that only China's kind of dynamic spending power can help stave off further large losses. This week, you know, and the last month, we've really started to see that kind of scale of damage. This week, Thailand predicted that their 2020 arrivals might drop 65% compared to 2019 to 14 million. In Indonesia, they're predicting just 5 million arrivals this year, so that's down two-thirds from 16 million last year. And in the early stages of the pandemic, you know, Singapore said, oh, we predict a drop of 30%. But I mean, they predicted that back in February and haven't had any revised numbers since then. And I can imagine that that is going to be severely kind of decreased. No way is it going to stay at 30% for 2020.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this really is, as you said just there, Hannah, this is putting that spotlight back onto the potential spending power of Chinese tourists, not just the volume, but the spending power. You know, this COVID slump extends way beyond the travel and tourism sector, of course. You know, governments here really need to quickly stimulate spending in their economies. We've been locked down for a long time. No one's been spending. So they need to revitalize not just the tourism sector, but they need to generate much needed indirect tax revenues from people's spend. I wrote about this at the weekend in our Sunday supplement article, Hannah. And you look at some of the warnings that are out there for the recessions that are coming in our region, you know, from quarter two, quarter three onwards, and they're pretty scary. Like Malaysia's finance minister said that the country is facing its worst recession in history. In Indonesia, the official government estimate is that poverty levels could increase from 9.2% to 12%. That's almost a 3% increase in poverty across the most populous nation in our region. Myanmar is negotiating with the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and the IMF for emergency funding. And Thailand has said that it's facing a shortfall of 1.1 trillion baht. And that's just from tourism earnings alone. So the economies of our countries are going to be hit very, very hard. This obviously has a knock-on effect into jobs, employment, security in terms of your own working environment, and also the ability to spend. Now, for our region as well, the add-on factor to that is that right now, this is the Indian summer holiday, school summer holiday season. So a lot of countries, particularly Malaysia, Singapore, Bali, probably Vietnam, maybe Thailand, would be welcoming probably record numbers of Indian families at this time. You know, that spending power would be in the economy. Obviously, India is locked down. India has not just a problem in terms of its outbound sector, but its domestic sector is completely collapsed as well. That's not coming back anytime soon. So this is really placing an extra emphasis on how much the region needs Chinese spending power. So the big question really, Hannah, is what happens next? You know, you keep reading and you keep hearing in the region that there are hopes that October's Golden Week in China will unleash some form of pent-up demand in what is the world's biggest outbound market. But, you know, October is a few months away yet. We've got to get to that point. And as we mentioned, China's own summer school holiday season takes place. That's usually in July and August. Again, that's a big travel period. But is that going to come too soon? You know, will Chinese government allow Chinese travelers to go overseas that soon? You know, we are probably quite doubtful about that. So there are a lot of questions that apply in the period leading up to Golden Week. We're also looking at perhaps we don't know what the level of outbound demand will actually be from China. You know, it probably won't be anywhere near what it was before. So then looking ahead beyond October, we're looking to the Christmas and the New Year season, which is, you know, a few further months out. So there's potential for people to feel a bit more comfortable about traveling by then. That is a big travel season from China. But also it's winter in China, so we don't know, you know, what the situation will be in terms of the virus, in terms of second and third waves, and also about whether people will feel comfortable traveling during winter.
Right. Well, that is a lot of questions. So we're going to break it down into five key areas. So we're going to look at developments in Chinese domestic travel, Chinese government, airlines, Chinese consumers, and Southeast Asian NTOs. So firstly, Gary, there have been some developments in Chinese domestic travel recently, right? The May public holiday. Is there anything there that might give us a clue about Southeast Asia?
Probably not is the answer to that. If you look at what actually happened during the May holiday, which is, you know, it's a public holiday, it's a good time for travel. There were 115 million trips made during that time, which sounds a big number, and it is obviously a big number. That was about 50% recovery from what the figure was back in 2019. So it's not too bad, but you know, analysts have been saying this week, even in China itself, that more was expected than actually was delivered. And there is a sense that, you know, people are still reticent to travel, even in their home country. Now, we did see that there was huge numbers of people at, you know, some of the key tourism sites in China. So Huangshan, the Great Wall, and the Bund in Shanghai. There were big numbers there. But there was, it seems, from the information that I have, you know, there was a strong impetus towards self-drive. People were a little bit reluctant to get on flights or on trains. There is still a great caution about, you know, booking too far out at the moment. So the upshot of that is that, you know, the return of Chinese travelers to Southeast Asia may not be the spectacular reboot that maybe some destinations are hoping for. There are signs of positivity. Hilton, for example, said that all of its 255 hotels in China have now reopened. Shanghai Disneyland has reopened. So, you know, the ability to actually travel and use these kind of venues or hotels, you know, hopefully will slowly gain some momentum in security and confidence amongst travelers. But I think at the moment, in terms of domestic, you know, we have to be prepared that it's nowhere near back to where it was before. Now, I actually sat in on a webinar yesterday by the European Tour Association, which was focused on Chinese tourism. It was very, very good, extremely good. They had two different analysts from China, one from a marketing company. And one of the quotes that I got out of that was from Kate Shong-Britton, who is the UK general manager for Trip.com, so formerly known as Ctrip. Now, I know Kate quite well. We used to work together in Shanghai. But she said that in the last couple of weeks, we can see that people are getting more positive about travel. But it will depend on how countries control the crisis and lift the lockdowns. So there are two elements there. You know, it's the security and the safety value of controlling the virus, and also it's the ability to actually travel. So, you know, lifting lockdowns, quarantine requirements, these things are going to be pretty important in the near future.
Yeah. So it's governments really that are playing a big role. So what do you think the role of the Chinese government will be in this tourism recovery, and why is that so important?
It's extremely important because the Chinese government obviously is involved in absolutely every economic sector in China to the nth degree, and tourism is absolutely no exception to that. China has its own tourism law. It was the first country in the world to actually enact a tourism law in 2013. That governs all aspects of inbound, outbound, and domestic. You know, China also is able to leverage its outbound tourism market. It is the world's largest outbound market, somewhere around 160, 165 million outbound movements last year. Now, remember, China is able to use this in its political and its economic and its diplomatic negotiations with other countries. So it has this political tool which it can use. But obviously, at the same time, this virus emanated from China, and the government is extremely wary that it doesn't come back. You know, we've looked at some of the hazmat suits that people have been wearing in travel sectors at airports in China. There is a huge reluctance to allow any opportunity for this virus to come back. And so that means, will the Chinese government actually permit Chinese travelers to travel overseas? We don't know. There is still a quarantine requirement in place for Chinese residents, and international travelers aren't allowed into China at the moment, but Chinese residents must do a quarantine when they return home. Until that is lifted, then I just don't think you will see any outbound movements from China, because people won't want to go back home to a 14-day quarantine.
No, absolutely not, yeah. So airlines, I mean, people are, if you're coming out traveling from China, you're normally going to have to use a plane to get there. So what challenges or what opportunities are there with airlines?
Well, this comes back to that point that I was just mentioning there in terms of the government role. And obviously, China's one of its key priorities is to protect its own economy. I mean, the economy was shut down in some places for 11 or 12 weeks, you know, and it's a huge economy. It takes a lot of time to get back up and running to full speed. It's nowhere near that yet. So there is, you know, there's this need to keep spending within China. And obviously, the tourism sector is an opportunity to do that. And that comes to the airlines, because that's an important point. If you look at the Chinese airlines, the big three airlines, so the state-owned airlines, which dominate the aviation sector in China, you know, they've been making huge, huge losses. Air China lost 4.8 billion renminbi in the first quarter. China Southern lost 5.3 billion. and China Eastern lost 3.9 billion. So if you add those losses together, they are huge, and that's only in quarter one. So what's actually happening in terms of the aviation market there is OAG mentioned that last week about 1 million new seat capacity was added into the Chinese domestic sector. So there is an opportunity here, and it will be government driven as well, that the airlines might be allowed to sort of grow and nurture their recoveries by the profitable domestic sector. And the international sector may be secondary for the foreseeable future while those airlines are allowed to generate more revenues and move back towards somewhere near profitability. I don't think they'll get profitable for a while. And the other issue with that is that, you know, if they are going to fly outbound routes from China for the foreseeable future, those routes are going to be pretty much one way in terms of revenue generating, because you're not going to see a lot of travelers from Southeast Asia heading to China on the return flights. So the airlines then would be in a cost efficiency conundrum, because they would make money on the outbound flights, but the return flights will probably quite often be empty. So they have a challenge there to deal with. In terms of the airlines from Southeast Asia, well, the aviation sector in China is such that the local airlines are protected and given the best routes. But if you look at airlines like AirAsia, for example, AirAsia has a lot of routes into different Chinese cities. It even flies into the city of Wuhan. And that's been one of its problems, because, you know, that was just that revenue stream was just completely cut off. Will it be able to will it be cautious about rebooting some of those routes? I would think it probably will. Which ones will be profitable for it? Which ones will it actually be able to operate given the quarantine requirements, the lockdowns? So the airlines are very, very important in this sense, because obviously they are the major player in terms of bringing Chinese travelers into our region. But there are a lot of factors to look at over the next few months. And I think that one about the China economy itself and looking at ways that the Chinese government can reboot the economy by keeping spending within the country, you know, I don't think we should override that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the government might want to keep the Chinese consumers inside the company, but what about the Chinese consumers themselves? Do you think that they still have the appetite to travel to Southeast Asia, or do you think maybe their expectations have changed post-COVID?
I think it's a bit of both, Hannah. I think there is definitely pent-up demand to travel. You know, we're seeing a lot of these sample surveys going around. And, you know, while they are sample surveys and they don't really tell you too much, you know, they do tell you that there is a willingness to travel. One of the things that we're going to have to learn from this fallout from COVID-19 is the difference between willingness and desire to travel and ability to travel are going to be two entirely different things. The ability is obviously governed by the number of flights and also, you know, the financial ability to do that in an era of unemployment, job insecurity, and less cash to spend. You know, will that level of demand actually be there? But in terms of consumers themselves, you know, I think they do want to travel. I think Southeast Asia is probably going to be a test case. As I mentioned yesterday, I was on this webinar about European travel, and there was general pessimism that the Chinese market to Europe is going to come back anytime before even spring 2021. And even at that point, I think there was an expectation that it would be pretty low level. There was a survey undertaken. The webinar had about 250 delegates, and they asked, where did delegates think that the initial rebound would come from Chinese travelers? And 43% said it would come from domestic and nearby destinations to China. So that does incorporate Southeast Asia. There are opportunities there. But there were some good quotes as well. So in terms of where we think that Chinese travelers will be in terms of how they want to travel in future, obviously health, wellness, and personal security are going to be absolutely primary. That's going to be for travelers all around the world. That's not just Chinese travelers, but because of the volume, that's really important. There's going to be, we think, increased importance in family travel, probably self-drive travel as well, health and wellness. And so there was a very, very good quote that was made there by a guy called Adam Wu. Now, Adam Wu is CEO of CBN Travel and MICE in Beijing. He's a very, very well-known analyst and operator. He works in the tourism industry, and I think he said he has been since 1986. He was one of the four runners in Chinese outbound travel. You often see him at travel shows and conferences around the region. Now, he made a very good point about Chinese travelers and hotels. And he said hotels will need to quarantine their rooms for a day or two before guests will accept staying in them. There is no way that they're going to stay in a room that has been occupied in the last 24 to 48 hours. And I thought that was very, very interesting.
So that would just completely change the model of hotels.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the other thing that he said that was quite interesting, he said that there is evidently from the research that they're doing Chinese travelers are looking online all the time at potential travel destinations and where they can go, and they are. But he said they're also looking very carefully, and they are checking the health and the medical news in the destinations that they want to choose. So, you know, this idea that we said earlier that, you know, destinations have to be COVID safe before they can welcome Chinese travelers, you know, that's hugely important. And that points to some of the destinations in our region. So if you look at, you know, Laos or Vietnam, perhaps Myanmar, maybe Brunei, you know, those have kept the official rates very, very low. Countries like Indonesia and Philippines are, I would imagine, going to struggle. Thailand, somewhere in the middle. Malaysia, somewhere in the middle. But there are a lot of other factors as well, and we'll come to those in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, and I imagine if they're looking at which countries have very strong health systems, then countries like Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore would actually do pretty well out of that as well, even though their numbers are a little bit higher in terms of cases at the moment.
Yeah, and I think the other element as well is, you know, Thailand, particularly Malaysia as well, they have strong tour operator relations with China. They've been dealing and bringing big numbers of Chinese tourists for a number of years. So they should be able to cope with this sort of changing expectation element. Okay, so and the other interesting thing that Adam Wu said is that tour operators in China are preparing and are starting to get ready to sell packages when lockdowns are lifted and when this crisis is over. So he says that Chinese will be among the first to visit virus-free destinations. Yeah, so I think those are some insights into, you know, how Chinese consumers might be considering the return to Southeast Asia. But what about the Southeast Asian context in terms of the tour operators and the tourism boards, Hannah? What's your feeling there?
I mean, for tour operators, it's kind of interesting because we had an article come out in TTG Asia last week that was saying that Malaysian and Singaporean outbound travel agents are still very, very bullish actually on the Chinese, well, more on the outbound market from Southeast Asia to China, which was interesting in saying that they still believed that Malaysian consumers and Singaporean consumers would still want to travel to China. And if we're looking the other side, so NTOs, what the tourism boards here in the region are doing, I mean, as we said earlier, their focus is very, very much going to be on domestic tourism. But we've also seen Cambodia talking in the last week or so about how China is going to be, you know, a really big step for them in terms of recovery. And they established, I think, was it last year or a couple of years ago, a center just dedicated to Chinese tourism and helping educate stakeholders within the industry about that. So they're kind of doubling down on those efforts. And we've also seen Thailand as well being very, very confident that Chinese consumers will return and soon. So I think they are very much trying to keep Chinese consumers engaged and updated with what's going on in those regions in the hope that if the government does allow them to travel out, then, you know, their destinations will be at the top of the list.
Yeah, and you made an interesting point earlier, Hannah, when you mentioned about visa-free access and visa waivers. You know, that had become so entrenched in the way that Chinese travelers were welcome, not just in Southeast Asia, but around the world, free visa access, to, you know, to reduce that bureaucratic time of actually applying and paying for a visa. Now, one of the interesting things that we've seen in ASEAN, that last week the ASEAN tourism ministers had a meeting, and they said that for the foreseeable future, there won't be any visa waiver deals. Now, I don't know how that will actually pan out. I don't know if they're trying to do a sort of pan-regional deal with China so that all ASEAN countries would get the same treatment in terms of visa waiver. I don't think that would work. China tends to prefer to do its negotiating in bilateral country to country. But, you know, that's going to be a key factor. If you're not going to have visa waiver, then, you know, you're really missing an opportunity to welcome back that spending power. So I think we will see some movements on that. Maybe that was just a kind of holding statement from the ASEAN tourism ministers until they can actually thrash out what they're going to do. But that's become just such an elemental part of the tourism industry that, you know, it would be crazy to disregard it. So, Hannah, that brings us almost to the end of this Chinese tourism special edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yes, and, you know, China is such a red hot, sometimes it's a little bit of a controversial topic as well in travel and tourism. So we would love to hear your comments and feedback on this episode. You can do that by email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or on our Facebook page at the SEA Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep, look forward to your comments and feedbacks. It's such a big topic that there are probably some elements that we've missed. So we'd love to hear your views on that. Also, look out for our daily travel and tourism updates on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show. And you can catch up on any of our back episodes that you may have missed on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com.
And don't forget to sign up for our weekly mini briefing e-newsletter. It's mailed out every Friday afternoon, and it takes a close-up look at the unfolding travel situation in one Southeast Asian country per week. So far, we've covered the Philippines, Singapore, Indonesia, and Myanmar. This Friday, it's, drumroll, Malaysia.
Yeah, we're bringing it all home. Looking forward to that one. And do take a look at our Instagram site at SEA Travel Show, where we post colourful shots from across Southeast Asia.
So that's a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to take our temperatures and sanitise our hands. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel and tourism again with you soon.
Yeah, thanks very much. Bye-bye.